This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
It started as a podcast about the first time you publish a book, and now it's about that and subsequent times.
For this, our fifth series, we've got our interview wish lists in order, and we have aimed for the top.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games. We'll ask them about their first times and what they've learned since then.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters Series. Tony Birch is a novelist, short story writer, poet, and academic. He's the author of three novels: Ghost River, which won the Victorian Premier's Literary Award for Indigenous Writing; Blood, which was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Award; and The White Girl, winner of the 2020 New South Wales Premier's Prize for Indigenous Writing and also shortlisted for the 2020 Miles Franklin Award. He is also the author of five short story collections: Shadowboxing, Father's Day, The Promise, Common People, and Dark as Last Night. His most recent publication is the poetry collection Whisper Songs. In 2017, Birch was awarded the Patrick White Literary Award. He is a much-loved member of the Australian lit world, a regular guest at writers' festivals, and a climate justice campaigner. Tony Birch lives in Melbourne. Tony Birch, it is always such a delight to speak with you, and I'm very pleased to have this opportunity again and to frame this conversation very much in the context of you as a leader or master. We haven't come up with a better name for this series yet, so I'm putting you in as a master of literature and words and ideas in this country. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Thank you for having me. But by the time this podcast is over, I'll come up with a new title. I'll be thinking about it.
Thank you. We've done a lot of putting different ideas out there, so please come up with one. When we were putting together our wish list for this series, you know, we kind of noted, oh, I've already spoken to Tony for the Apollo Bay Festival, but the fact that every time we've talked for events or indeed over lunch, I'm not sure that you've ever told the same story twice. So no pressure, but I'm hoping for all original insights today in this conversation.
Well, obviously you haven't been to my house for dinner because my daughters and son will say that I only tell the same story.
So. Okay, excellent. I'll take that as an invitation. Thank you, Tony.
Here we go.
All right, so let's begin at the very beginning. For our context, what's the first thing you ever remember writing, Tony Birch?
Well, I went to a Catholic school. So I went to Catholic school both in primary school with the nuns and the Christian brothers. And there was a subject that was taught at Catholic school called composition. And clearly what that was to compose stories. And I was very good at it. So the two skills that I had many deficiencies as a student. And the two skills that I had was that I was a very good writer technically. And I've always had, I think, a great ability to off the cuff be able to create a story. So in other words, yeah, well, I can tell original stories from experience. But if you ask me to tell a story about a horse, and being someone who's not particularly interested in horses, I could probably come up with a one-page story about a horse fairly quickly. But I think the first story from memory, and I don't know if it was the first story that I wrote, was a story of living in Fitzroy in this early 60s when the demolition for the Atherton Gardens housing estate began. And I don't want to bore people with my expertise as an urban historian, but although the area that became the Atherton Gardens estate wasn't fully demolished until about 1960, it was remarkable that the Housing Commission of Victoria began to spot purchase individual houses and demolish them so people couldn't move back in as early as 1960. So we faced a weird sort of period of growing up, say from around 1960 when I was three till about 1967 when we were one of the last houses to go. Of seeing houses, you know, every day being sort of bulldozed around you. And the first story that I ever wrote was, and I remember I was chastised by the nun for this, of because of great anger of seeing houses of friends demolished. I remember writing a story, I may have been about 6 or 7 years old, or maybe 8, about smashing a window in an empty house, but without being able to really articulate it at the time was that almost my act of vandalism wanted to preempt a bigger act of vandalism. And I think in the story I actually wrote, I wanted to smash the window before the bulldozer smashed it. So it was a strange act of defiance. So, and I remember distinctly, so I reckon I would have been in maybe grade 3 or 4. And I remember one of the nuns, you know, reminding me that it was a sin to smash a window. And for fiction writers, I remember saying, if you made this up, it's not a sin, but if you actually smash this window, you must go to confession and speak to the priest about it. And I told her that I'd made it up, but we used to smash windows every day of the week. So that was the first story that I remember actually putting to paper.
That's really interesting. And gosh, I wish that that was somewhere in the archive, because I was just reading a piece that you wrote recently, and we'll link to it, about demolished homes. Home is not a home, or home is not home. And I was thinking about how often you write about things that are gone, places or people, or that idea of demolished homes. And I wanted to ask if you consider your work to be a kind of active archiving of things that have been lost.
Yeah, and I think that, yes, I think so, definitely. I could go for a strange list and then answer the question. So quite literally, my first childhood home in Carlton was demolished. My second childhood home in Fitzroy was demolished, and including, you know, all the signposts that I knew. So my grandmother's house next door, my great-grandma's house behind, my godmother's house, you know, street corners, milk bars, hotels that my old man drank in. So the playground that we played in, gone. Then we went to Richmond to the Housing Commission. Even the Housing Commission flat we grew up in Richmond is gone. That was replaced by another house. We moved to a house in Collingwood, gone, replaced by the Eastern Freeway. So many parts of the river that I've loved, gone, sort of hidden by the Eastern Freeway. So literally until about the age of 16, no physical evidence exists of any house I lived in. They're all completely gone. And my writing, which reflects those landscapes and those places, it's not only about conjuring that past, it is truly about the sensibility of feeling those places in a literal sense when I visit them. So I still live in Fitzroy, but if you take, say, the Collingwood House near Dyches Falls, I run along the river there, you know, several times a week. And to get to where I begin the run, I have to walk along a nature strip or plantation where my house once stood, and a really important house. I was there as a teenager when we were swimming in the river a lot. And I do get quite a visceral sort of physical and emotional sense of its presence. So it's not just about places that are lost, but it's about their sort of almost, you know, spectral or ghostly presence in a contemporary sense. So I don't feel I'm just drawing on the past. I'm trying to deal with feelings that I experience every day, so that if I'm walking around Fitzroy, I'm not one of those people who's nostalgic and saying, yeah, this place is, you know, you don't know how great it used to be, and it's fucked now, etc. It's not that. It's my experience of walking around the streets here is that I still feel the presence of those past experiences in a very real and contemporary ways. So if I'm writing about those places, I draw on my feelings now, not so much just drawing on historical memory.
How does that link in? Because I know you have done and you continue to do a lot of work with climate change, both in academia and action as well, and working with young people. How does that link into that idea of solastalgia?
Well, I think one of the things we need to get away from, and I experienced this, I can't go into detail, it just would take too long, but several years ago I was very lucky to be part of a European Union project which was working with 15-year-old kids in Europe. And I mean working, I worked in schools in Dublin, I mean parts of Poland, in Berlin and in London. And the kids tend to be kids who were themselves living on the margins, or, you know, sort of working class kids. And one of the things that I realized was that if we want to talk about loss of place and our value of place, that we should stop talking about it as wilderness or nature, someplace out there beyond our experience or beyond our daily experience, unless we live in the bush. And to say, well, wherever you live in the inner city, on the coast, it doesn't matter. Your place, not only, of course, will it be affected by climate change, but urban landscapes are as vital to our psyche and our way of understanding the world as some sort of natural landscape. So, for instance, the kids in Dublin, Kate, one of the things that I found really important to talk about is that, yeah, they lived on a, you know, what we would call a public housing estate in Australia, these council estates in Dublin, really poor estate. And these kids were so poor, they'd never been into the centre of Dublin and they'd never been to those, you know, sort of beautiful green hills of Ireland. And you could actually see them from where I was in my hotel room beyond the edge of the city, this beautiful mystical landscape. But these kids had not even experienced that level of outdoor experience. They basically just hung around the, you know, a local sort of shopping centre. And when I got them to think about climate and loss of place, they only understood it as a place beyond their experience. So they knew about bushfires in Australia. They knew about dramatic weather events that they'd seen on the media. So then I said, well, what's your place? Yeah, where do you go when you want to, what place do you love? And it turned out to be a paddock at the end of the street where they kept their ponies, you know. And I said, well, that's what you need to think about. You love getting down there. Yeah, they hang out with their ponies. Have a cigarette, probably do all sorts of other things that adults don't think they're doing or don't want them to do. And that was their place. So I got them to write about the paddock. So that for me, I don't see my interest in writing about the inner city as any different in writing about the protection of country. All places are vital and valuable. I live, as I said, in Fitzroy. And last night when I was coming home, I noticed these beautiful parrots sitting on a wire just outside my place. And, you know, I just think to me that's as important as any other experience with nature or wildlife. So I think the way that we need to think about places is that all places matter and we need to think about the protection of all places that we have and that they're part of our actual daily life.
It's such a strong theme throughout all your writing, and so much so that when I think of you, Tony, I often think of your work as a map, because you talk about and write about Fitzroy and Carlton and the river kind of running through it like a pulse. And I know you've told me before that you walk with your grandkids around the same laneways of Fitzroy you grew up in. What is that map of Tony Birch, and which places feature most prominently in it?
Well, I mean, the map is literal, so you can't see it, but at my desk I have a sort of a wallpaper on top of my desk, which is a map of Fitzroy produced in the 1930s. It's a map of sort of desperation of, you know, a Christian reformer. This map was produced to highlight all the pubs and wine bars and, you know, dens of depravity in Fitzroy, mm-hmm. So that's why I love it. I've also produced fictional maps. So when I did the book, The White Girl, I created a fictional map of the fictional town of Dean. So one is I'm actually interested in maps, and something I used to do as a child, which I suppose is not everyone's habit, is that I would, you know, when I was with my nan and we'd go to op shops, if I saw an old atlas or an old street directory, I'd buy them. And then I used to reinvent the maps, like create little stories on a page of the map and turn it into a sort of a fictional place. And that's obviously stayed with me. I think the other issue relative to this is that I think it's why my camera is so important. So I take a lot of photographs when I'm walking, and some of those are for documentation, for a story I might be thinking of or that I will think of. But I think also the photograph really interests me because the sort of photographs I take are often of what we might call a section of a place rather than, you know, like a vista or a standard landscape photograph. And I think it's about when you go back and look at the photographs, you're looking to reinterpret that landscape.
Tony, you said then about photographs, and I'm interested in the way that writers record and store their materials for their work. Is the act of taking the photograph enough for you, or do you, you know, archive them by content or stick them up on your walls or go back and look at them as inspiration? What do you do with them?
I do go back and look at them as inspiration, and there are particular places where I will have gathered photographs. So there's a place out at Williamstown, of all places, the old rifle range, which is called Jawbone Nature Reserve. And I've taken a lot of photographs out there with the view of writing a novel or a story based out there, which I have not done. But those photographs are both documentation and what I would call story triggers. So yeah, that they will be in the one file. Same as when I was writing the novel Ghost River, I took a lot of photographs along the river. And this is the point you're talking about mapping and the relationship. I didn't need to, because I know that section of the river. I mean, that novel is set between Collingwood Children's Farm and Dyde's Falls. It's about a kilometre. The kids only inhabit that one section of the river. And I know that place back the front. So there was no need to take the photographs. But I'm a strong believer, yeah, when I taught writing, is that I actually believe about the idea of engaging with a place where a story is being performed, and you will learn from that. So, yeah, in that case, I definitely file the photographs. Sometimes I think a photograph is interesting. I've always been interested in photography. And again, not to bore people with my background as a historian, but people may not know that there's a history of portrait photography, both landscape and people. But photography also in the 19th century was almost seen as a science. And frighteningly, photographs of so-called criminal suspects were sometimes used in the same way we would today use fingerprinting or DNA. So, yeah, people who studied what's called phrenology would look at a photograph of a subject and say, yeah, he has a burglar's nose or a sort of murderer's ears. And that could be used as evidence. So what I mean by that is photography is seen as scientific. Where my understanding and love of photography is that it's completely uncontrollable, in the sense that your engagement with a photograph changes over time. It's reinterpreted, you're building other layers. So one of the reasons I love taking photographs of a place is not that they'll give me a realist, you know, narrow understanding of that place. It actually opens up all sort of fictional possibilities or interpretations. So That's the main reason that I love it. So there are particular photographs that I've taken over the years that are, for me, quite seminal in a fictional or philosophical sense. I have a photograph that I keep on my desk that I took in Japan of a sort of dilapidated kids' playground near the coast. And I wanted to take a photograph of one of those tire swings. Hmm. And then when I developed the photograph, I saw that there was an old man just in the center of the tire swing down on the beach. You know, I see the top half of his body. So it was one of those great photographic accidents that then, there's something so symbolic about that appearance of that figure in the circle. So in that sense, that I could imagine that photograph being the basis of a really important way to think about a story.
I love that phrase, story triggers. That's great. Something else people might not know about you is that before you made that move to university and to becoming a historian and a writer, you were a firefighter.
I've had more weird jobs than that. My three jobs that are claimed to fame are my first ever paid job was a telegram boy. And people don't even know what a telegram boy is, but I was a telegram boy at the Richmond Post Office.
Were you ever tempted to open the telegrams? Did you read them?
Oh, no, you saw all of them anyway, because they came in on what was called a teledex, and then you cut them and you put, you always knew it was in the telegram. And, unfortunately, most telegrams in those days were quite mundane. So they'd be between businesses. Weirdly, you think, well, why don't you just ring someone up? But one of the things that, this will excite people, when I was a telegram boy in Richmond, there was a major meatworks in Richmond. And when the workers went on strike, which meat workers always went on strike in the early 70s, a lot of people didn't have telephones. But more importantly, when the management had ordered the men back to work after, say, a resolution with the meat workers union, every worker would be sent a telegram that, of course, they had to sign for, so they couldn't say they weren't ordered back to work. So we would, on those days, have hundreds of telegrams to have to deliver to meat workers.
Oh, that's nice.
There's the usual sort of, people used to send telegrams for people's birthdays, for weddings. And of course, occasionally you have the really sad outcome where you have a telegram in your house, you'd be delivering to an old woman, informing her that her son who lived interstate had died, or mm-hmm. her husband had died. So you always knew what was in the telegram. So that was one of my jobs. I think the most bizarre job I had, which people find a bit uncomfortable, I was a surgical barber at a hospital for a year. So that is actually preparing male patients for an operation by literally shaving any bodily hair that needs to be shaved, which could include nipple to knee, front and back, if they were getting a quadruple bypass. So
how did you get into this, Tony?
Well, this is frightening because people would expect you to be trained. In those days, and this sounds quite bizarre, I only took this job because you could get 12 hours overtime on a Saturday. By the way, not to get away from literature, I actually have in my second book, Father's Day, my second collection of short stories, I have a story which is based on the experience of being a surgical barber. But basically, with the technical job, so I'm sort of playing the truth because being a writer, my technical title was theatre technician. So I spent a lot of the time in operating theatres, setting up for an operation, and then sterilising and cleaning after the operation, and assisting during the operation if a surgeon needed light shifted and stuff like this. But each night after you thoroughly scrubbed and cleaned the operating theatre that you're in charge of that day, if you're doing the afternoon shift, you did all the surgical shaves that night, and there was no training required. It was on the job, and to literally be on the job was to say my first pubic shave was with another guy whose nickname was Swooper, who was teaching me how to shave while we were shaving some poor old guy who was on his hands and knees on his hospital bed. And my friend said, look, I'm just going to show my mate how to do it. So I did that job for over a year, and it was very interesting. But then I left there and joined the fire brigade, where I was for actually quite a long time, for 9 years, from when I was 21 to almost 30 when I went to university. So people have always said I should write a firefighting novel, but I've declined. I'd rather do the calendar, but no one asked me to do the topless calendar.
So there's so much material in all of those jobs, and I know in others you've had too for writing. What made you move away from, you know, surgical shaving and fire and all of these intense kind of work environments to the university?
Well, I can tell you now that if anyone's thinking of a career of a surgical barber, it's not an old man's job. It's a young man's profession. You can slip up with the razor, so you need to be literally sharp on the pun. So I actually love that experience. And to be quite serious about it, there is something that I love. If people ever ask me what was the most, well, it's hard to say a best job, but a job that most affected me, it was that job. And what I loved about it is I work in the operating theatre during the day. So this is at St. Vincent's Private Hospital. A lot of the work was, you know, quite technical. It was the major centre for microsurgery in Melbourne at the time. But it's also a maternity hospital. So that cesarean births were, of course, done by operation in the theatre. And, yeah, I'm a 21-year-old kid, and seeing babies, you know, born through cesarean, it was just an incredible experience. And although it didn't happen as often because we were not dealing with emergency, you know, people occasionally died. But I think what I loved about it is what I love about writing. It's an intense, immediate emotional experience. So it's an emotionally charged experience where people dealing with those sort of things like death or you become quite clinical. It's the opposite. Is your relationships with people you work with are really emotionally intense, really emotionally intense. So you feel, and I know it sounds like a cliche, but you really feel full of life. This is something that really matters. There's nothing mundane about it. I mean, it is interesting that in those jobs that at the time, yeah, people, because of the job, you know, a lot of people would drink heavily into other forms of substance abuse, like, you know, taking laughing gas when you weren't supposed to. And I think, you know, not personally, but people have quite intense sexual relationships. I think it's all that, it's charged. It's a really charged environment. And I felt that. And again, I think it's part of being younger, but I loved it. And same with the fire brigade. It could be a lot of downtime, but when you're on, you're really on. And yeah, you never experience that as a poet, you know. The alarm doesn't go off. And I think that I really, partly I missed that. So when I went to university first as a student, but then, you know, I wasn't writing creatively as in fiction and poetry. I did a PhD in history and I was teaching in the history department and writing academic history. It was a good job, but for me, it was never particularly exciting. Teaching was sometimes really exciting, but I think as the university system changed and became more process-driven, heavily bureaucratized, that really impeded on the joy of teaching. And to me, you know, this is not nostalgic. I see that as a real loss for both students and teaching staff that's changed so much. But I did get a real buzz out of teaching when I felt, well, this classroom or this lecture theatre, this is the one space that myself and my students still have control over, and therefore to make that work effectively. And when I was teaching creative writing, like in any other job, I had some fairly mundane and sometimes some terrible experiences. Teaching 500 students in a lecture theatre to do creative writing is not a great idea. Mm-hmm. And when the university got obsessed by big courses, that was the outcome. And it was really just trying to get through. But when I would say teach short fiction to an honours class, so this is fourth year students who really stuck with the writing program, it was quite intense because they were really passionately engaged in the subject matter. And not to my credit, but several of those students have since gone on to, you know, publish. Mm-hmm. And it's because they stayed with it and they had a great passion for what they were doing. So that was some relief from the sort of more mundane aspects of being at university. But I think, to be quite honest, that writing and the sort of writing I do, it's the one way of reconnecting with those passions. So that I just mentioned a story I wrote in my second collection, Father's Day. And although it is, a, you know, my protagonist is a pubic hair shaver, it's not that. It's about the intensity of one of the patients who suffers alopecia, which is the complete loss of bodily hair because of a traumatic event in his life. So it's really about that intensity and closeness and intimacy between people, which you don't get in other ways. And again, I'm not being romantic or nostalgic. To work in a university environment was never exciting socially. Yeah, I got very few friends from my university days. Yeah, I'm not saying people are bad people, but they're just not interesting. Yeah, nothing happens.
We'll just put a little disclaimer at the start for anyone who was a colleague of Tony's. Your first published collection was Shadowboxing, full collection in 2006. What was the process from an industry kind of perspective now? What was the process that you went through to get that published?
Oh, that was really interesting, Kate, because when I wrote the collection, just to give an insight into what I did, I wrote down keywords, literally just keywords of either of memories, what I would call marquee stories from childhood or early adulthood that I'd experienced or stories that I'd been told. And just to sort of quickly, so a story like The Butcher's Wife, which is the most dramatic story in the collection, is based on the crime of a woman who we knew very well, who cut her husband's head off and his arms and legs. They're the sort of memories you never forget.
No.
But there was a story called A Small Good Thing, which was based on my grandmother telling me a story about, yeah, what we would call today backyard abortion. So, of course, before abortion was legalised, thankfully for women, yeah, women would go through all sorts of, you know, life-threatening procedures when they needed to have a termination. And it was based on the experience of my mother and grandmother having these strange relationships where the story is really about that all women needed a relationship with this woman who performed terminations. And backyard can be a, you know, fairly negative term. This woman, in relative terms, did her job, you know, as best she could. but it was a strange thing where all women needed to know who could do this work, but they were publicly, they had to shun this same woman. So in other words, while they might over their lifetime have a relationship with such a woman, they wouldn't want to be seen speaking publicly with her because that would, you know, incriminate them, so to speak. So that story is not one that I, of course, experienced personally, but it's a very strong childhood memory. And it's one that's always stuck maybe when people, anyone starts to talk about, you know, pro-life, to think of what these women went through, as of course, it, we know. But so basically, I started to publish those stories individually, Kate, and then I didn't approach a publisher because people may not be aware, back in 2006, no one was really interested in publishing short story collections. Luckily, Henry Rosenblum at Scribe Publications, he published my book and Kate Kennedy's Dark Roots, which is just such a seminal book. Yeah, Kate is like a classic sort of writer's writer. People just love her short stories. And they asked me to come and see them because they'd seen one of my stories published that they really liked. And, yeah, they'd seen a couple others that had come out. And I was asked if I had a collection, which I didn't. I said I did. And basically it was a really easy relationship. At the time, I think there were six linked stories that were working quite well. I was given some advice on what I might do with what we might call now independent stories. I went and wrote a couple of new stories, rewrote a couple of old ones, sent it back to them. Aviva Tuffield, who's now my publisher at UQP, she was an independent freelancing editor at the time. We had a really good relationship in the editing. And it was very easy, that relationship. And in relative terms, the book was very successful because, again, most other than Scribe, other publishers who had asked me about my work basically would say, well, if you ever do a novel, get back to us, but we can do a short story collection. And that was, yeah, all the big publishers. And I still remember that Rosenblum said to me, he called me a boutique writer. But one of my students said,
that is not the word that comes immediately to mind.
One of my students said I was the Gillian Welsh of the short story, which I still don't know what I meant. I love that. I absolutely love that. I think what he meant was, yeah, Gillian Welsh's Welsh's CDs were getting passed around dedicated listeners, you know, but she wasn't sort of known to a wider public or a big public. But anyway, he said to me, look, if this book eventually sells 3,000 copies, we'll be really, really happy. And it sold remarkably well in the sense of a short story collection. I don't sell like big tons of books like the big Australian writers, but it sold 1,000 copies in readings in Carlton in a year and two copies at readings in Hawthorne.
That is when data is really useful, right, when it tells a story like that.
It literally still sells about 500 copies every 6 months. And so I think it's probably sold over 10,000 copies.
Which is incredible.
It's still on the shelves. It's still being taught. So it's had that book has had a great life. And it's a book, you know, that I'm really proud of. And, you know, I suppose when people talk about your greatest memories as a writer, one of them is seeing that book in the window at readings as my first book. It was sort of surreal to think that it was actually happening.
Tony, you've gone on, obviously, to publish more short story collections, but also poetry and also novels. Was that, you know, do you know what form a material is going to take and the way it's going to come out on the page in terms of material you use for a poem or what you've gone on to use for novels?
I do. The poetry is like occasional forays. It's like a hobby that you can't get rid of. I don't say this either jokingly or dismissively. I don't see myself as a poet in the true sense. Yeah, because quite honestly, I know several poets really well as friends. And someone who's like a poet living and breathing as a poet, their dedication to the form, their attachment to the form is much different than mine. Yeah, these people think of poets. They experience their day as poets. And I think that's a great understanding of who you are. I don't think as a poet all that often. And I think I go through quite intense periods where I get back to poetry. So Whisper Songs, my last collection, with the exception of a couple of poems, was written really over quite an intensive period. And then it's gone. It's like So, but with the, I think if we look at the novels and short stories, yeah, I tend to know immediately that this is a short story. I think the other thing is I have a lot of confidence in the ability to go from the idea for a short story to its completion. So once an idea for a short story crystallizes and I think, yeah, I'm going to write this, I'm fairly confident that I'll get an outcome. And when I say an outcome, what I mean is there's a difference. At some point of the writing, I think, okay, I think I'm going to get to what I would call a publishable quality. That doesn't mean the story would be published, because that's a different thing, because, you know, writing is also a lifetime of rejection. So, I've had short stories rejected in the last couple of years, only two, and I remember who the people are, but their names and addresses.
He's coming after you.
That's just a fact of being a writer. You've got to accept rejection. And with the novels, I think it's a different process for me. It's not that I don't have as much confidence when I'm, well, of the outcome. So the three novels I've published, when I finished the draft, I thought, yeah, and particularly The White Girl, the last book, I was really happy with the outcome of saying, yep, I know what I wanted to do and I've done it. But during the writing of a novel, it's much, I don't feel that level of confidence of where I am. It feels like, well, it is harder work. And people would say, of course it is, because it's a length. But it's not just that. I think one way to articulate this for other writers and non-writers, it's that when you begin a short story draft and you hear that note, so, you know, this is going to put people off, but Noddy Holder, the lead singer of the great band of the 70s, Slade, I still remember a concert where he asked the guitarist for an A, give me an A, and the guitarist plays the note and Noddy Holder then sort of just sings a little bit, and he's got his pitch, and he goes, and he says, right, and then he goes on to sing. So he gets his pitch, and he knows where he is. When I start to write a short story, I want to get that pitch, and when I've got it, I can stay on note. I can stay as close to the pitch perfect as I hope to, and that stays with me for the 3,000 or 4,000 words. When I'm writing a novel, you're always needing to find your pitch, or I am, or to re-articulate it. So, in other words, there are more dud notes in those first drafts. So it's simply, it's not as enjoyable in the sense that you've got to work harder. And that's, when I say it's not as enjoyable, I accept the fact I've got to work harder. I reckon I've written short stories where the story sort of wrote itself and just used my fingers. So, you really think, and that term people use, sometimes you're really on, like today is a great day to write, and you'll get a, I have had days where I've got a whole draft out because the flow is there. You just keep going because it's working. So that's a difference for me. And I think for some novelists, they might get on pitch straight away. Readers, not writers, are surprised by this, but readers sometimes are. Some people, still think that a short story is a sort of an apprenticeship for writing a novel, which is really dumb. And I know that when I go back to short stories, because it's actually the form that I love the most. I love the short story form, both as a reader and writer. And I know great novelists, really great novelists that I've talked to, and they've said to me, I don't know how you write a short story. Whereas I think, what are you talking about? You just wrote this gorgeous 400-page novel. And they will say, I don't know how to write a short story. And that takes me back to when I was a teacher, that I would know that when I taught that short fiction course, that I would know that I'd be teaching some students who are novelists. And you know that because they're writing it very good technically. But even in their short stories, and 3,000 word story, it's not really a story. It's the beginning of possibly a novel, and a great novel. And that's the way that their creative brain is working, and that's fine. So it's knowing what's going to work around an idea. And having said that, each of my novels has come out of a short story, not out of laziness, but the fact that with the short stories, particularly with my second novel, Blood, I wrote a long short story of 7,000 words for Charlotte Wood, an edited collection called Brothers and Sisters. I knew when I wrote that story that that was going to be a novel, because I knew that these two kids, Jesse and Rachel, that I wanted to do a lot more with them.
Tell me about the practicalities, Tony, because it seems from the outside, you know, you're already quite prolific and it seems you are getting more prolific as time goes on. How does the writing happen? How do you get it done? How do you divide up a day between, okay, this time is for reading or this time is for walking or running or whatever else? How does it happen?
Well, I used to be prolific. What's funny is I retired from academia coming up to 2 years in June. I've done less writing since I've retired than I ever did. And I think it's quite serious that when I was working, I was probably more anxious about getting the time to write. So I would write anytime I had a break. And now that I've had a real break, I like having a break. But having said that, of course, I edited the two new books that came out last year. So that was Dark Was Last Night and Whisper Songs. I've been publishing what we might call memoir essays. I'm still publishing. But to be honest, I haven't written a fictional project, short story or novel, began anything for about a year. But I think that's because I needed to have a break that I'd never had. So certainly I'd worked always full time from when I published Shadowboxing until I did the first draft as Dark As Last Night. So I think not writing has actually been good for me. I'm not in a sort of situation of writer's block or anything. But when I say this, people get surprised, is that even enjoying my writing, my priorities, for instance, I wouldn't, if I had to make a choice of going for a run or a ride, I wouldn't miss a run. I love reading, so I wouldn't miss my reading. What I think I found is that, and for all writers, is that you've got to find a habit, a work habit that is effective for you. And I tend to think that I write quickly, or I can get a lot of words, but I wouldn't write more than 3 hours a day. Like when I hear about people writing 8 hours a day or, you know, going down to their office at the convent or something and sitting, I said, well, what would you do all day if you had, people said to me, do you want a studio space? I said, well, what would I do? I wouldn't be there that long. I write in the morning. So if I was working on a novel, which I expect to be doing soon, I'll probably do something like write from about 9 till 12, then go and have a run during the day, then have lunch, go and kick around my grandson or something. So I when I get into a project, so once I begin a project, I am very methodical. I've always said again to students, you don't hope, you can really deceive yourself. And I think this is one of the problems of young writers where they make the act of deception is, they keep putting it off and they say, well, I'll write it next weekend. I'll do it this day or that day. And a lot of it doesn't happen, or you start to cram, and of course you write very badly if you force it. So and my advice to other writers is always to find a method that's really regular. And so I would probably write five, I wouldn't write on a weekend, for instance. I'd write 5 days a week, and I'd probably write, say, from 9 to 12. When I go back to beginner session, I would tend to read over what I'd written the day before again, just to hear the notes that I'm working with. I might have taken notes in my journal that I need to look at. And if I do that, I'd probably look at getting about 2,500 words done a week, which is plenty. Mm-hmm. And I agree with what some writers say. It's good then your writing session on a high. So if you start to feel that it's starting to be a bit laboured, it's a good time to finish. So I think once you start to force it or it's getting untidy, you're only putting words on the page that you're going to have to go back and repair the next day anyway.
I wanted to ask you about running. I've recently taken up a very, kind of shuffle kind of form of running. But I was reading Murakami's book on running and writing. And I wanted to ask you what the connection is for you between running and writing.
Well, firstly, the running, not only does it still come first, it was first, so that my father, who passed away in December, was completely mad. But part of his madness was an obsession with physical fitness, which I can't even go into the detail. People couldn't believe it. But we started a nightly regime of exercise when I was five. Yeah, and my older brother and sister, my sister's got the best left hook in Melbourne.
Wow.
So we started when we were five, literally on a regimented exercise program of weights, of aerobic fitness when I was five. The kids that we lived in the housing commission in Richmond thought we were like, our family was insane. So every night at 5 o'clock, me, my older brother, the older sister, and my father would set off on a long run about 5 o'clock every night. So that was from when I was 10 till I was about 15. And I was really good at athletics, so really good sprinter at school. And then when I was 15, my dad got really sick and went into a psychiatric institution. So with him away, I stopped running and took up a serious hobby of drinking and smoking. And then when I got to about 22 or 23, I hadn't really looked after my fitness. So I played football. But yeah, you can play suburban football and smoke at half time in those days.
Yeah.
But I thought, no, there's something missing. And it was about 1979. I started running, and just people talk about muscle memory. I remember going for those early runs when I was in my early 20s and remembering what my body loved about that physical fitness, even though my dad was crazy. And at the time I resented some of it, I actually loved the tiredness after a run. So I stopped drinking and smoking and started doing marathon running. And so I've always done that. Now that I'm 65 in March, I'm shuffling as well, so we could go for shuffle. I run much less. So I run about 5 days a week, and I only run 8Ks a run. So I'm running about 40K a week and running a lot slower, but enjoying it just as much. And if we have any aging runners listening to this, I can say that one thing that happens as you run for such a long time is you're running a lot slower as you get older. This starts to happen in your 40s, but you actually don't know it. The experience is the same. The joy is the same. But it's relative to writing is quite serious. So the one is that running for me does declutter my brain. So it's like creates that blank sheet, which allows you then suddenly to solve a problem. So it would be the case that I never go out for a run thinking I'm going to solve a problem, but I'll be running along and then somehow a story that I'm writing or a character that I'm stuck on or they've got a problem, I'll start to think about it and I'll have a clarity that I never have when I'm sitting at my desk. And when I was writing Shadowboxing, I still remember this in a story called The Lesson, which is about boxing. I wanted to describe the father's attitude to giving his son less boxing lessons very, very simply and clearly. And I couldn't work out how to describe it. And I was going for a run and it just came to me. And it was like the father, Mick, he doesn't like boxing at all. He loves fighting. Mm-hmm. So even though he's teaching his son to box, he wants his son to fight, which is different. So those sort of problem solving is important. Obviously, it clears your brain. What it never is about people think, oh, there's a narcissism to running. You want to stay young or you don't want to die. And all my friends who drink and smoke, when we go out to school reunions, I'll say, I know a bloke who ran for 40 years and then he was out running, he had a heart attack. What could happen to you? Well, it could happen to me, but it's nothing to do with that. It's about enjoying that on the day that you're doing it. So it's a great experience. And I have found that if I'm injured and I haven't been able to run, my writing does stall. So it does all work together to give me a clear head and a clear sense of what I'm doing.
Tony, in a number of interviews, you've kind of laughed about the fact that your fiction is so often described as bleak and the fact that you don't necessarily mean to do that, that you're just writing your own experiences, your truths. And I suppose there's also often humour and hope. And if not those things, I think are kind of an energy or a fire that works back against the violence or the darkness. Is there a way that you would like your work to be perceived by readers? Or are you of the opinion that, you know, the reader is always right in whatever way they take your work?
Well, I am of the opinion that the reader is always right. I mean, critics are not always right, but readers are always right. In that sense that, you know, as a writer, you're in a relationship with a reader, and you can't ever expect that a reader is there to accept these tablets from the mount that you've delivered. And the joy of being a writer is, in fact, that generosity of a reader's experience being their own. I mean, that's the best you can hope for. So just on a positive note, when I go and talk to particularly reading groups, say at, you know, local libraries, Yeah, these are often older people, most often older women who are just so well read. You know, these people read like every day. Yeah, some of them read a novel a week easily. They're so well versed in the novel that when they give you feedback on your work and they've experienced something in it that you didn't realise, that's what I love about being a writer. On the issue of bleakness, is that no, I wouldn't want to persuade people to think about it differently. And to be honest, again, you go back to shadowboxing, and I'm not trying to typecast here, but that's not the experience, say, of middle class white women of the suburbs. But when I went out to reading groups and spoke to, you know, middle class white women of the suburbs, you know, 60, 70 year old women, they understood that book. Because they understood about silence in men in their own lives. They understood about what it is to be a woman in patriarchal society, even if they don't seem to have experienced it the same way. And the feedback I would get off those women is great. The other thing is that I found the same with a novel like The White Girl, although it's about an Aboriginal woman and an Aboriginal granddaughter, again, not only women, but generally women in particular, they understand the attachment between an older woman and a younger woman, whatever their, you know, their identity. So I've had great feedback. People who say the bleakness in the negative, so the first review of Shadowboxing, which was in Books and Publishing, said, oh, this is a novel about domestic violence, murder, alcohol and mayhem. You'll need to take a it's so depressing, you need to take an upper or something, you know. Now, I don't write for that sort of reader. I don't want to change my work to please that reader. And to be honest, yeah, people read for pleasure. People read light. People read genre fiction. People read romance. That's fine. I wouldn't suggest anyone read anything other than what they enjoy reading. But when people say, I've heard about your book and it sounds important, but I couldn't read it because I don't like to know about that stuff, well, that person is not my reader. So I'm a great believer that, you know, I've said this before, that, you know, the world is difficult. The world is not easy. And I prefer to focus on difficulty and in a relative sense, and I don't say this lightly, that when I think about, like today, we can get really depressed and you're reading the paper about this terrible situation developing in the Ukraine. You think there are people about to go through really horrific experiences. So what I'm doing here and what I'm writing about and what I'm engaging with, there is a privilege of being able to do this. And if people can't confront the difficulties of life that we have to deal with, I don't know what it says about their understanding of the world personally. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I like stories where characters are tested, where characters' morality is tested, where their courage is tested. And yeah, I've done a lot of stories and books where the courage of children is vital to the outcome, which I love. So that I once had to see a grief counsellor after my younger brother died. And yeah, we had a very sort of difficult childhood. But she said one of the characteristics that she felt was important for me as a person was that I think you have incredible resilience. So my characters, my children, are quite resilient because they are tested, and that's what I'm drawn to. And you can't write about something that doesn't have that depth of passion. So a friend of mine, Ross Gibson, uses a beautiful word where he talks about what he calls reiteration, that writers often, there's the one idea that they keep going back to, that's reiterated time and time again in their work. And what it is what you're trying to do through fiction is literally you're trying to make sense of the world. And I think for me, I make sense of the world by putting characters in situations where they're tested.
You've been in the industry a long time, and you know, you're a staple at events and festivals, and you've been published by a number of different publishers, won awards, etc. What do you love most about the bookish world in Australia or the industry? And what, if anything, would you like to see change?
Well, what I love is to reiterate what I just said in some sense is I love a relationship with the reader. I love meeting readers and talking to readers. So yeah, people often say that, unlike going to festivals, and it's a necessity, etc. I love going to festivals. You stay in better hotels than you would otherwise pay for. The reason I love going to festivals, you know, a lot of my writing mates, I only catch up with at festivals, particularly blackfellas. You know, you go to festivals now, you know, big festivals like Sydney or Brisbane, and there's a whole sort of circus, an entourage of Aboriginal writers from across Australia, and you all hook up, and I love doing that. But I think the most important thing is that I really love meeting readers and I love talking to them. And, you know, because I live in Fitzroy and, you know, no one knows me outside the inner city of Melbourne, I'll be walking around the street and someone will say, oh, are you Tony Birch? And I'll say, oh, I just read your book. And they're sort of quite shy about it. And it's not an ego thing, just having that conversation on the street where someone talked about your book. Now, obviously, the people who like it are the ones who say, hey, are you Tony Birch? Don't like it, walk past you. But so I love the relationship with readers most of all. I mean, when I say what would I change, look, to be honest, there's not much. You're quite powerful. Well, you are relatively powerless as a writer because, you know, it's an industry. It's a commercial industry. I suppose what I would like to see, which I taught writers, and I can, you know, think of them, particularly a couple of young women who I think were as good as, and better than any writer that I've read. I can think of a woman that I taught who I don't know why no one ever published her novel. So I would like to see publishers take a bit, well, I don't know if it's called chance, but I know it's a commercial industry, but there are writers out there who I think do remarkable work and no one will take a chance on them because they worry about the commerciality of their work. And I understand that. I understand that. But it's a shame. And when someone has ever said, what would be the worst thing to happen for you as a writer? It's not a bad review. I mean, I've had mainly really good reviews. I've had a couple of shockers, but we all have to live with that. And that doesn't worry me at all. It would be, honestly, if I wrote a novel and no one wanted to publish it, I would find that very, very difficult because you put work and time into it. And I know a lot of people have unpublished novels, but that's quite deflating. And I think that there are people who have written great manuscripts and they never get published. And I'd like to see more debut authors getting an opportunity. And I think I think the industry is healthier in Australia, certainly much healthier than when I wrote and published Shadowboxing. I would like to see more debut authors getting a go. And you know, when we think of the industry, if I was the prime minister or if I was running the country for a week, I'd bring in legislation that would actually put much more money into young artists than established artists. So I'd put more into the front end.
Mm. Wish you were. Let's put you in for just a week. Last year, you had an interview with Astrid Edwards for The Garret where you mentioned some future projects, including, and I quote, a big feature crime novel set in the 60s, which you say you've been thinking about for years and years and describe as a sort of transgressive anti-woke crime novel. Tell us more, Tony. Are we going to see this novel?
You are definitely going to see this novel. It won't be the next novel. The next novel will be a novella. It'll be finished this year. And that's because strategically, I won't go into detail, but my publisher owes me a hard cover over something that went wrong. So when I made my list of demands, they thought it'd be money, and I said, no, I want a hard cover. So I'm going to have a quieter novella, I think, out next year. And then I've written synopsis, scenarios, beginnings of this big novel, and it will be set in Fitzroy in the 1960s. When I say anti-woke, I was just, me and Astrid were just mucking around. But at a serious level, there is a real issue here, is that I want the novel to use the language of the time. And that language is very challenging to the world we live in. Now, I'm not suggesting, of course, that we should go back to the way that we spoke about each other and we spoke about each other ethnically and in a sense of gender and sexuality, etc. But I don't think I could write a novel set in the past which in some ways is unable to utilise the street language of the past. And also, though, in a way, if I could just finish by giving you an example, I have a story in Common People called Frank Slim, and it's a story about a man for hire who will do anything of a criminal and violent nature for anyone who will pay him. And the woman who pays him to do, you know, medieval harm on a low-level criminal is a madam, a brothel keeper, who is attacked by this low-level criminal. She wants to protect a young child who's in her care in the brothel, which is based on a true story, by the way, of a friend of mine who was brought up in the Fitzroy brothel because he was left on the street, and this wonderful woman took him in and raised him. It was a great story. But in this story, she says to her assistant, "Get me Frank Slim," the sort of fear, and she pays this Frank Slim to, you know, torture this man. Now, some people find that story very uncomfortable because they say, here's a woman subject to physical violence and possibly sexual violence, and her only way of getting justice is to pay another man to be violent. Yeah, this is not the way we should think about male violence. And I agree, in 2022, don't get me Frank Slim. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got to do something better than that. But I can tell you now that when I grew up, my mum would have got Frank Slim. Mm. And when my mum read that story, she loved that story. And she goes, "Oh, I love that bit when he, you know, stunk the boot into him. And I love the bit where she just waved her finger and he slashed him." So when I say about wokeness, what I really mean is in that day, women, if they were subject to violence, they couldn't go to the police because the police would do nothing, or they were known to be violent. Fitzroy police were known to rape women in themselves, right? They couldn't go to their family because their husbands or partners would go around and assault their other family members. They couldn't go to other men who'd say, "It's not my business." So if women wanted to get justice, what they would resort to was something like that. So the story that I wrote, The Butcher's Wife, that's based on a woman who the only way she can get justice for the years of domestic violence is to kill her husband. Women who could afford to could say, "I'm going to hire a man to do my bidding." And in that story, the woman, you know, basically makes that statement. "It's my decision and it's my money, and this is how I'm going to use it." So it would be a novel. I suppose, Kate, what I'm talking about is relative morality. Mm. It was a very moral society, but its morals sort of wouldn't be understood by people today.
Mm. I look forward to it so much. Of course, as always, I run out of time with you, but I've got two more questions, if you'll allow me. I don't know. You've been, you know, you've taught creative writing for a long time, and I don't know if you're planning a kind of George Saunders Swim in the Pond in the Rain kind of style book about all your writing lessons. But no. Say you were going to, Tony, what kind of lessons do you reckon would be the most important to include for students of writing, people who want to be the best writer that they possibly can?
Well, they're two really simple. I do occasional masterclasses, although I've been looking at my desk. I think you should call me the Rocket. I've got a beautiful rocket here on my desk.
The Rocket?
Yeah, see this rocket? I mean, your viewers won't.
Ah, yes.
So the Rocket, I'll go with that.
But, okay, the Rocket, great.
The first one is, there are two things, yes, very quickly. One is, as I talked about before, one is to find a method that allows you to work most efficiently and best, and that is basically a work habit. So make sure you have an ordered and structured writing week. And if you're really busy, as some people are, and say, "Well, I could only write 2 hours three times a week," do that. Write 2 hours three times a week. Be a bit selfish about your time in a way of understanding you've got other commitments, but stick to that. So it's about a method and a dedication and a regularity that brings you work. And that's the first one. The second one is very practical. I'm a really strong believer. The two, I think, traits of any good writer, or two traits at least, are really good observational skills and an insatiable sense of curiosity. So I always believe in documentation, whether that be using your notebook, whether it be using your camera, is to go out, walk around, do some observation, look at people, watch people in a cafe, on a train, whatever. And then once you see something or hear something interesting, write a little note about that. And what you're doing there is you're exercising your creativity. Some of those ideas will possibly form themselves into characters or stories, but if none of them do, it's like limbering up. It's, you know, like about getting your body limbered up for exercise. It's getting your creative self limbered up to do the work. And I think you should be doing that all the time.
Brilliant. And to finish, I know when I listened back to your Apollo Bay interview with me, I think that in there you gave a list of poets, which is kind of like a masterclass in itself. And I know that you're a generous kind of reader and you shout out to lots of new writers all the time. I don't know if you've got a recommendation of a debut book, any time or any genre, or if there's just some works that you feel our listeners should be reading right now or catching up on if they haven't. Well,
one, you're going to have to help me here. One is Jessica Au's new novel. Is it called
As Cold as Snow? Correction, it is not called that at all. Jessica Au's book is called Cold Enough for Snow, and there's a link in the show notes so you can buy it.
That was a beautiful book that I read only a couple of weeks ago. I love that, which, you know, it was probably a perfect day for snow when it did snow, but that is actually a beautiful book. And one I'm just starting, so it's like a recommendation before the event, but Mandy Beaumont's novel, The Furies. I loved reading about the novel and I bought it only yesterday and I've started it. And it's one of those books, you know, you open it up, you read the first, I think only 20 pages, but you think, yeah, I'm with a writer, I'm in here and it's going to, I'm really, so say with Mandy Beaumont's The Furies, this is a really great sense of being a reader. You buy a book that you really want to love. Of course you want to love it. You open a book and you think, oh, I don't know about this, and you give it 50 pages, maybe a bit more, and it doesn't work. And it's always disappointing because you want the writer to succeed. I've opened up the book expecting to enjoy it, and what I've read so far, I thought, yeah, this is gonna work. And yeah, talking about bleak, I mean, this is not a romance novel, which is, you know, who needs a happy ending, you know?
Tony Birch, fabulous recommendations, and as always, an utter delight to talk with you. That was completely original. Hadn't heard any of those yarns before, so loved it all. Thank you so much for being our what are you calling you? Our rocket.
The rocket.
Sorry. Get it right, Mildon Hall.
It could be 20 rockets. I'm the rocket.
The rocket. Tony Birch, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.